General is the faculty or the power for thinking the particular as contained under the universal. That's simply Kant's general account of what a judgment does. It's the power for thinking the particular as contained under the universal. There are two ways of seeking to subsume particulars under the universal. The first way is if the universal, which can be a rule or a law or a concept or a principle, all those are variations on the notion of the universal for Kant. If the universal is given, I've got the universal, and judgment seeks to subsume the particular under it. So the important point here is we have the universal cat. And then I go around and I find a cat and I subsume it. I'm that kind of guy. This is the only notion of judgment that appears in the Critique of Pure Reason. And it becomes, in the Critique of Judgment, determinative or determining judgment, right? Which is... And... this is, properly speaking, an adjective, but for reasons we'll come to, it's useful to think of it in the gerundive form as determining rather than determinant or determinative, because, above all, it's an activity. So I'm going to, the one thing I actually agree with Guire and Matthews about is there are uses of the gerundive. And I will talk about determining judgment and reflecting judgment so that we're clear that these are activities. In the Critique of Judgment, Kant suddenly comes up with a second notion of judgment. First introduction, page 211. Where he gives his definition right at the very beginning, paragraph 5. Judgment can be regarded either as merely an ability to reflect in terms of a certain principle on a given presentation so as to make a concept possible, or as an ability to determine an underlying concept by means of a given empirical presentation. In the first case, it is the reflective, or reflecting. In the second case, the determinative power of judgment. To reflect is to hold given presentations up to and compare them with either other presentations or sentence that should be totally opaque to you for the present, one's cognitive power itself in reference to a concept that this makes possible. In the second introduction, page 179, he gives a similar account, only there he does not specify that there are concepts involved, but just gives the notion of determining and reflecting. So the thought here in reflecting judgment is in this case only the particular is given, for which the universal must be found. When that occurs, then the power of judgment is merely reflecting. There are, according to Kant, five forms of reflective judgment. And I want to open up, I'll tell you what they are, and then what I want to do today is open up a story about their possible connections with one another. So first is reflecting judgment involves searching for a system of scientific laws. And I will explain in boring detail how this actually arose in the first critique. There are two forms of aesthetic judgment, judgments of beauty and judgments of the sublime. And there are two forms of teleological judgments. Judgments of particular organisms and judgments of nature as a whole. And a lot of the energy of the Critique of Judgment is seeing how those five forms of reflecting judgment, and I can see there's no reason for you to understand why they're bits of reflecting judgment. That's what I'm about to try to explain. How they come together. Now, the way I want to begin is I want to follow the genealogical account of the coming to be of the third critique that Jack Sumito gives in his book on the genesis of Kant's Critique of Judgment. Sumito, following a guy named Tonelli, offers a kind of archaeology of the different layers of composition of the third critique. And for purposes that will become clear, I think understanding this will help sort out some of the issues underlying the text as a whole. We know that in late 1787, that Kant had just finished the Critique of Practical Reason, and he was turning to the composition of what he thought of at that time as nothing more than a critique of taste. And the critique of taste was to cover just those topics that he mentioned in that letter I talked to you about last week, namely feelings of pleasure. So the original Critique of Judgment was composed of what is now paragraphs 1 through 22 and 31 through 40. And it was just what we now think of as the critique of the beautiful, judgments of taste. Something happened in the intervening 18 months because by the May of 1789, he has composed the first introduction, the unpublished one. The first introduction was not published during Kant's lifetime. Right? So I'm spending lots and lots of time on a thing he never published, didn't care about, threw away. Exactly. Always the place to go. And in this, he suddenly is interested in the critique of teleological judgment. But in thinking about the critique of teleological judgment, Kant, for the first time, develops the idea of the faculty of judgment power as a whole. That is, he had not considered the idea of the faculty of judgment power as a whole as something separate about which he could write a critique. The origin of this idea probably comes from a topic in the Critique of Aesthetics, namely the intellectual interest in the beauty of nature, where we have an interest in nature as if designed artistically. So that when we appreciate nature, we treat it as like a work of art, but because we treat it as like a work of art, then we are thinking of it as somehow intended, and so we have to judge it teleologically. Further, at this moment, Kant gets the idea that reflecting judgment, because it can be used teleologically, can be used for the purposes of cognition, to generate a coherent philosophy of science. So part of the interest for Kantians in the first introduction is that, in a real sense, it is Kant's philosophy of science. Not the first critique, because that's just kind of general nature of judgment in general, empirical judgments. Here he talks about how science is possible. And this coheres with his account of what he calls, in the Critique of Pure Reason, the notion of ideas of reason which have a regulative use. And I'm going to explain what that is in about 10 minutes. Finally, sometime in the summer or fall of 1789, all of this Kant suddenly takes an ethical turn. Probably because of his struggles with pantheism. Pantheism was a bugbear for him. And this gave the whole book a much more metaphysical appearance, above all by positing, as we were just talking about, the idea of a supersensible ground of both subjective freedom and natural order. And this also probably underlies his interest in the notion of the sublime. Now, it matters to the way I'm going to tell the story of this book that the ethical turn was very late, that he had already written everything that is significant in the Analytic of the Beautiful already independently of it, and that further, that he had developed the idea of reflective judgment as a whole, again, without any concern for ethical or moral topics. So there is a whole school of reading the Third Critique that justifiably, given what I just said, thinks that you have to read it all through the lens of morality. I think the issue of morality is the least interesting and least convincing stratum of the argument, and I will talk about it, but I am going to marginalize it. Well, I can do that in part because I have to answer the question which we ended up the last hour with, namely, what is the space possible for talking about judgment at all? The first hint of an issue of judgment occurs in the First Critique in a famous passage at A132. He's going to raise here is simply the question of how, in concrete terms, is judging possible. And he says, general logic abstracts from all content of knowledge, and the sole task remaining to it is giving an exposition of the form of knowledge as expressed in contents and in judgments. And then here comes the famous passage. He says, if it sought to give general instructions how we are to subsume under these rules, that is, to distinguish whether something does or does not come under them, that could only be by means of another rule. This, in turn, for the very reason that is a rule, again demands guidance from judgment, And thus it appears that though the understanding is capable of being instructed and of being equipped with rules, judgment is a peculiar talent which can be practiced only and cannot be taught. It is the specific quality called mother wit, and it lacks no school, etc. Okay, this is the problem of the application of rules. And the question is, I've got the rule for cat. How do I know when to apply it? And the problem here is that the rule for cat says, you know, anything that's furry and purrs and answers to the name, you know, St. Bonaventure is a cat. Well, how do I know when to apply that rule? So I need another rule. So to tell me that. And then we have an infinite regress of rules. So there cannot be an account of the application of rules that itself is rule-bound. For Kant, judgment is an art and not a series of laws or algorithms. Now, in some ways, this is not totally convincing. Think about airplane landing systems. They are judging how the plane is going to land. The pilot puts it on automatic, and now it's going through an amazing series of calculations, doing the wind, the height, the thing, but it's making an application, right, of its series of rules to apply to these particular circumstances. So there's something about the application of concepts that probably does involve some relationship between causal input, right, and a kind of form of a feedback mechanism of a particular kind. But there are other cases where Kant seems right to me. For example, the two ones that are most obvious to me are learning a new concept and extending a concept to a new situation. Now, the reason that these three things, concept application, learning new concepts, and applying it to new circumstances, what they all share and what Kant could not think and did not think in the Critique of Pure Reason is that in some way we must be encountering an object independently of a concept. But that is heresy, right, for First Critique Kantism, because he says, right, that the full cognitive meaning of an intuition is given by the concept that subsumes it. So the question now is, there's a puzzle now about how we can apply, learn, and extend concepts, because something about our powers of cognition seems necessarily, I want to argue, to operate without full conceptualization occurring. Now, the situation for Kant is, as he begins to think about this issue, becomes even more extensive. The best way of formulating this, and I'm here following more or less Zimito's account, is to think about problems of underdetermination of empirical knowledge by transcendental theory. That is, what Kant began to think about is that the Critique of Pure Reason provided the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience. But in providing the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience, it exhausted its power to legislate at the level of transcendental possibility. Which is to say that if you have the Critique of Pure Reason on its own, you do not have sufficient resources to explain how actual empirical judgments are possible. So that what you get in the Critique of Pure Reason is very remote. Transcendental necessary conditions for the possibility of experience, but not actually anything like even the necessary conditions for actual experience. And this can be thought of, the best account of this limitation occurs in a book not on your reading list by Susan Neyman. What's Neyman's book called?
Something in Reason.
But it's her only Kant book. And Levine's going to think of it.
Unity of Reason.
Unity of Reason. What else could it be? Yeah, the Unity of Reason. And she goes crazy because she wants to think about how reason comes in. And she's saying part of the problem is the understanding. Okay. I don't want to confuse you yet. Now, we can think of this as three levels of underdetermination. Level one. The problem of the individual entity. When I make a judgment for which the technical expression in Kantian jargon is synthesis of recognition in a concept. When I make a judgment, I bring an intuition under a concept. Cup gets deep. This is a cup. Well, that sounds okay, except for this. That if every judgment was like that, this is a cup, and this is a cup, and I can go around the room, this is a cup, small cup. But even when I say it's a small cup, it's a red cup, what I'm never going to get out of those sorts of judgments is full individuality, the concrete, this cup itself. That is, the very nature of concepts are universals, and by bringing individuals under universals, I, to use Adorno's phrase, I say what they are not in themselves. That is, of course, it is a cup. It's not wrong to say it's a cup, and it's red, and it's got writing on it, it has a white top, but I'm always going to lose the thisness of it, right, under my conceptual apparatus. So the first problem is that, and one way of thinking about this is I am going to lose my own sensory awareness of the thing. So in the passage I will keep kind of coming back to this evening, the next few weeks, unless we stay here all night, at 2:20 in the first introduction, In the middle of the page, Kant says every empirical concept requires three acts of spontaneous cognitive power. Apprehension of the manifold of intuition. Apprehension of the manifold in intuition. No concept is mentioned here. The question is, what on earth is apprehension here? What might apprehension mean? How is it possible? Or, in the Critique of Pure Reason, it gets passed over. It's a moment that is always sublated in a second moment. Here, Kant is worried about this first moment. He's worried about this moment of apprehension as independent from the following two moments, namely comprehension and exhibition. Or, to say it one more way, we never get the notion of a contingent this in the Critique of Pure Reason. And indeed, for reasons I'll come to, I don't think he thinks it's possible. Yeah?
Even your example of the cup properties is already using empirical concepts, of course.
So of course.
It's already at a level at which...
Great universal... That's my point. Yeah. That was the point of the example. I am already... And this, of course, for those of you interested, this is what Adorno's entire philosophy is about. That Adorno's philosophy is about we identify things by bringing concepts to them that come from us and subsume, where now the word subsume means dominate, means to equalize, to make the same. Now it happens, they now make all the cups the same anyway, right? But that, of course, is Adorno's point. Capital works by doing just that, using the rule to make the same over and over again, and therefore there's nothing new, nothing individual. Nothing uniquely this. And one of the reasons we're interested in artworks, in principle, is because they are supposed to be unique, particular thises. But then if they're unique, particular thises, how can we think them? Puzzle one. Puzzle two. And here the relevant passages are the long footnote at 211 and page 213. I'll just use the 213 passage. I'll let you read the footnote on your own. He says, and I'll explain this, he says, how could we hope that comparing perceptions would allow us to arrive at empirical concepts of what different natural forms have in common if nature, because of the great variety in its empirical laws, had made these forms as is surely conceivable, exceedingly heterogeneous, so heterogeneous that comparing them so as to discover among them an accordance and a hierarchy of species and genre would be completely or almost completely futile. In order to think, to judge, to know about the world, we must be able to bring intuitions under empirical concepts. But in order to classify intuitions under empirical concepts, we must be able to compare intuitions, to determine how like or how different they are. And we need to do this in order to form new concepts. That is, for Kant, the only innate concepts are the logical functions of judgment. Empirical concepts are empirical. If they're empirical, we learn them from experience. How is it possible to learn from experience? That is, what are the conditions that make the generation of concepts, even in principle, possible? And Kant is here imagining this passage. He says, you know, we might have all this transcendental apparatus, but the world appear so chaotic, so disorganized, that we could never reuse a notion. But if you can't reuse it, then it's not even a concept. It's a proper name. And if we had just proper names, we'd have no thought at all. So the claim here is that in order for us to have empirical concepts at all, natural phenomena must not be so heterogeneous that it would make it impossible to regard those objects as possessing shared empirical properties. Which is to say, nature as a crude, chaotic aggregate would make reflection on the given representation to produce a possible concept impossible. So even to begin the business of knowing the world, we're going to have to make some presuppositions. Now, this is the issue as to whether there is a sufficient minimal order in nature, a clustering of natural objects into natural kinds in terms of objects and properties, to make ordinary empirical concepts possible and hence empirical cognition possible. One of the things that Kant is assuming here is that nominalism is just silly. And the reason he thinks nominalism is just silly is because it doesn't explain how we think anything. Right? That is, we can't just say two things are alike because we say so. But that's what nominalism must claim, that what makes two things alike is the name we give it. That's the definition of nominalism. But that is incoherent, because that name must actually latch onto it. So I can, of course, say, I'm going to give this the name red, but something's going to, you know, I can say what I want, but it won't latch on. If I can't carve up nature as I merely want to, rather, they must latch on to something. And this is just what, the problem here is concepts just are, in their structure, universals, right? They are necessarily reapplicable to different objects. Furthermore, for Kant, empirical concepts, because they are universal, are either themselves highly condensed laws of nature or are derivable from laws of nature. So, for example, red. Something is red if and only if it appears red under standard conditions. Right? And then I can actually back that up with a bigger law of nature about, you know, wavelengths of light. Something is a cat only if when I kick it, it says, meow! Right? I mean, and so on and so forth. Right? They have to. Ordinary concepts embed counterfactual conditions. So our ordinary conceptual practices, our use of ordinary nouns and ordinary adjectives and so on and so forth, are all bound up with law-likeness. Right? And therefore, we actually have to be latching on to things and can't be, of course, there's some arbitrariness we could cover, what, but there must be sufficient grounds even for multiple carving.
There are questions. Yeah, Ruby.
Okay, you may not name it, but the thing is, why wouldn't the aggregate of similarity not be judgment? Like, okay, you may not have to name it, but the thing is, when considering the aggregate of similarity, like things with similar properties that seem similar, like, why is that not a judgment? Why would that?
That is a judgment.
Yeah, okay.
No, the question, you're missing the point. The question is that at the transcendental level, all we know is that anything that must appear must accord with the categories. It must be a substance, it must be determinable causally, etc., etc., etc. That's not enough to show how empirical knowledge is actually possible. There has to be more features of the natural world that we presuppose in having empirical knowledge than those already given at the transcendental level. That's the thesis. Yeah?
Is it considered as something outside the mind, or is it like split within consciousness, like Hegel?
Neither, it will turn out.
Okay.
This is why it's going to be different. I mean, I'm saying what we need. I haven't said how we're going to get it yet. I'm saying what we... Let me be clear. What I'm talking about is problems. Remember what our problem was is, where is judgment coming in? And I'm now trying to lay out a series of problems in Kant's theoretical philosophy that were unanswered in that theoretical philosophy that require different capacities of judgment, it will turn out, than those already given in the theoretical philosophy. And not only that, but we're going to have to figure out how we're going to justify those. And as I'll say in a moment, if I get there today, that a version of what I'm talking about now is a version of the problem of induction. Right? If you think about it. I'll come back to that in a moment. You're all clear about this problem. This is really pretty near the heart of the problems that drive people to this book. All of Hannah Ginsborg's writings are about this very sentence, more or less. Some other wacky accounts, but she's worried about this problem above all. She's right to be. Yeah? Please.
Isn't this
is problem? Many cups.
Sorry, the problem you've identified here seems to be at the heart of the third critique in terms of identifying how we make the, not just the judgments, but the judgments of qualia. And if you define this, then that gives us the entry point at the same time for making the judgments different from just a subjective opinion or different from it. Identify the objective third perspective or the second or third perspective, however many numbers you're going to add to that.
Well, maybe. all I'm interested now is I'm really interested in, look, Kant was not Leibniz. Maybe this is a good way of trying to think about this. Leibniz tried to show that the world is the way it must be. Kant said, we can't do that. All we're really capable of legislating a priori are the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience. Because only at that level can we get any kind of necessity. Right? Because the opposite of possible is impossible, right? I mean, we just get it backwards. But now we're trying to approach the world. In approaching the world, it turns out that there are more conditions for judgment than those transcendental conditions. And we have to make more assumptions about how the world is or must be for knowledge to be possible than we have already made. And I'm trying to show why we must make those more assumptions. And the example I'm giving now is a crude chaotic aggregate. We'd have nothing to apply our concepts to. So we have to make some other assumptions. Same problem at a different level. Third problem. A system of laws. It may be the case that what I've just talked about at level two, ordinary concepts and laws, that we have that. We can talk about cups and tables and cats and lions and hippopotami and stars and students being stung by taser guns, all that stuff. But all these aggregate of different concrete judgments are themselves so capricious and unavailing that there was no prospect of coherence among them. That is, we couldn't unify our knowledge into one systematic whole. But this would enter into direct conflict with the assumption of nature as a unity. How could it be the case that every object is in causal relation with every object at the same time and causally continuous through time, and yet there not be a system of laws that apply to all of these objects? So, prior to Newton, we had perfectly powerful accounts of terrestrial mechanics. And we had perfectly wacky accounts of the movement of the heavens. But what we didn't have is an account of why cannonballs fly, the kind of laws that govern them, has anything to do with the motions of the heaven. Yet they're both just moving objects. But how could it be that there are moving objects on Earth that follow different laws than they're moving? But the law world could be like that. That's logically possible. But if it was like that, what we think of as natural science would be impossible. Therefore, natural science too, and therefore the business of systematizing our knowledge, making a coherent body of knowledge, too, makes a bundle of other assumptions. Now, these are all problems of the underdetermination of the phenomena by the transcendental laws of experience in the first critique. But they open up a new domain of thought or inquiry. So this is the space that wasn't there before. Right? So what wasn't there? In thinking about those dark looks, I can see the man, he's gone mad, what is he talking about? Okay. What we didn't have is any space for thinking about the problem of judgment, what it might talk about. And I've now identified three areas thinking about intuition as concrete individuals, reflecting on objects in order to make concepts possible, and reflecting on existing knowledge in order to make science possible, all these are possibilities necessary for knowledge that are not yet available to us according to the principles of the Critique of Pure Reason. Stephen.
Maybe you're going to get into this, but it seems that at least the first cannot be accounted for, what I'm about to say, but two and three can. Why not just use the regulative ideas? For two and three, at least, one, there's a problem that can't be addressed. But so the apparatus, the first critique, we make the ideas of reason very robust. Why isn't that sufficient for two and three? Why do we need this new apparatus?
Well, the first answer I'm going to give, I'm going to beg the question one way, but one way of doing this entire business is by doing regulative ideas, and that is the way that Guire does it in the essay, in his own essay, in the book he edited, Kant's Critique of the Power of Judgment.
So he thinks it's continuous with that theory.
Not only does he think it's continuous, he thinks that it's all about regulative ideas, and judgment is about the prosecution of regulative ideas. So he thinks it's all about system, even aesthetics. And the aesthetic system is a system of judges.
But do you buy that?
No.
Okay.
But that would be my answer, that I want an account. How do I want to say this? For me, it is the connection between levels one and level two, that is thinking of the individual qua individual, and thinking about individuals as possible objects of new concepts that are brought together by thinking about the judgment of taste. And that therefore I want to make the judgment of taste central to Kant's systematic philosophy, and I want to sideline the issue of the system of scientific laws. Not that it also isn't reflective judgment, but I'd rather bring it into harmony with the rest of it than the other way around. So, as in much of life, my position is the opposite of Guire. But I recommend Guire's essay is an attempt to think this problem from the point of view of the Critique of Pure Reason, and just to extend... I'm going to have to say something about regulative ideas. No. I think it's important because I think one of the things that we think about, and I want to talk about this because we think, oh, let's talk about art and aesthetics. And by the way, if you're interested in art and aesthetics, please take another course. This is a course in epistemology. It's full of difficult stuff and epistemological stuff. It just so happens we work it out with art and aesthetics, but, you know, it's the problem of the concept that I'm interested in. It's the problem of judgment I'm interested in. And therefore, it's helpful to see it in terms of the problem of the philosophy of science as intimately connected with the problems of aesthetics. Now, both of them bring up this question of reflective judgment and in an analogous way. Okay? So what Kant says... So I'm going to now talk... This is, I guess, what we're doomed to. Yeah, we're only now a week behind. Sorry. Before I go on, are we all clear about these three problems on determination? The difficulty, for those who have done the first critique, is under determination with respect to what? and it's the undetermination with respect to the apparatus of the critique of pure reason. I am going to press on and not do the regulative ideas because I think it will be helpful. And I'll come back to that next week. Yeah?
I have one question regarding the first of the problematics. Yeah. Before, you made a comment that what happens when you never get the full individuality of the particulars is that you lose your own sensory awareness.
Yeah.
What did you mean by the phrase, lose your own sensory awareness? The
perfect. Great question. Great question. Let's say I say that this is a cup. For anything to be a cup, it must have such and such properties. Right? Then what it is to be a cup will be fully exhausted by the laws specifying cupness. Right? But then what happens? So now that I've got it, this is a cup because it exhibits just the properties of cupness. But wait a minute, I actually had an experience. I actually felt this thing with a certain weight, but it's not the weight. If you translate my feeling of weight into, 1.5 ounces, so weighs 1.5 ounces, is red, is rat, right? And suddenly, the sensuous experience of that disappears. Now, you may say that the ideal of knowledge in the Western tradition is to translate all knowledge into science. That is, so that we can get rid of everything that depends upon the individuality of experience. Surely, that's what's meant by the thought that intuitions without concepts are blind. They're meaningless. They're nothing. But if they're nothing without concepts, then intuitions get all their meaning from the concepts they're brought under. But if they get all their meaning from the concepts they're brought under, what happens to the little intuition? What happens to our experience of it? The actual seeing, the actual judging. Right? Somehow, our way of thinking about knowledge eliminates something central. Us. So what the problem of the critique of judgment is, in part, is to show we can't have knowledge without the actual judgers judging. So the activities of judging, with all the sensory characteristics and aspects of that involved, are necessary for empirical knowledge. That's what constantly be arguing in the critique of judgment. Or, to use the phrase that I'm going to elaborate in detail next week, what I'm going to be arguing for the next 14 weeks is that every determining judgment has a moment of reflecting judgment in it. So, reflecting judgment, the kind of judgment that is our non-conceptual but nonetheless cognitive encounter with intuitions, is the necessary condition for conceptual experience generally, and therefore the translation of conceptual experience into science is actually a betrayal of empirical knowledge. That's the thesis of the whole course. That's why I think the third critique is a critique of Kant. It's Kant's, because Kant was the philosopher who most thought that all knowledge needed to be translatable into science. And he thought that because he did think that intuitions without concepts are blind. It just turns out, as he, and this is why Kant is a great philosopher, as he began thinking about the actual mechanics of it, he was rigorously honest. And as he worked out the details of the Ohm process, he actually ends up generating conclusions that go beyond the original theory they were meant to defend. And some of the thrill of this book is seeing Kant not determining ideas, but following the path and the rigor of thinking to take him places he would not want to go.
This is what is enlightenment, right?
Yeah. All that. All of that. Absolutely. So, let's think about this question of underdetermination for a moment. See how far we get. Kant, on the basis of this principle of underdetermination, is going to have to think up a new a priori principle that is in itself, in its own way, a necessary condition for knowledge. And this is called the principle of the purposiveness of nature, or sometimes called the technic of nature. Now, what I've been trying to do is to locate a series of problems of underdetermination as simultaneously carving out a space for the operation of judgment. Right? So I'm going to, wherever there's underdetermination in the original theory, I'm going to stick reflecting judgment. Right? But to stick reflecting judgment, judgment has to have a principle at the basis of it. And in paragraph 4 of the first introduction, page 209, he tells us what that is. So after giving the story, at the beginning of 209, he gives the story, what if we couldn't systematize nature? What if it was empirical laws would not allow for any unification? And he says we presuppose unification because we presuppose the unity of space and time. And then he says in the second paragraph, in the middle of it, therefore, it is subjectively necessary for us to make the transcendental presupposition that nature, as experience possible for us, does not have this disturbing, boundless heterogeneity of empirical laws and heterogeneity of natural forms, but that rather, through the affinity of its particular laws under more general ones, it takes on the quality of experience as an empirical system. Now, this presupposition is the transcendental principle of judgment. I'm sure you all relieved to hear that. All right, what is he claiming here? He's claiming that we have to, and I want to, he's going to be claiming something to be both necessary and subjective. This is the trick here. This, that nature is not chaotic, is a necessary presupposition for what? For the possibility of inquiry. It is our idea of the intelligibility of nature as a system. If we cannot undertake scientific inquiry without presupposing this idea, if this idea is necessary for the minimal activity of knowledge getting, then if necessary, then it's transcendental. But it's transcendental in the way in which nothing in the first critiques is transcendental. Because it is also subjective, by which I mean it provides no basis for theoretical cognition of nature at all. It does not tell me, and on the basis of it, I cannot know, nor may I even believe, that nature is orderly. I am not entitled to believe it, I cannot know it, I cannot stipulate it, I cannot posit it, none of it. But then what does it mean to say I must presuppose it? The presupposition relates not to nature itself, but governs my activity. It's a transcendental presupposition of my activity that I act towards nature, why not say it? As if. This is the kind of as if exactly. This is truly Kant's as if, in Kant's own view. I must act towards nature as if it were orderly for the sake of doing science. That does not guarantee it will be successful. It does not give me any knowledge of science, of nature. It does not even allow me to believe that nature is orderly. To have that belief would be absolute speculation on my part. Rather, therefore, this is only a principle for judging and investigating nature. So it's a principle that sounds like it's about the world. Nature is orderly. But in fact, it is about my stance or attitude toward the world internal to the activity of acquiring knowledge of nature. Think of it this way, and this is Allison's way of thinking about it. Think of this as if it was the problem of induction. It's a version of the problem of induction, absolutely. Right? The problem of induction what we've been thinking about in terms of level 3 is the problem of empirical chaos. Okay? And the problem of empirical chaos is a version of the problem of induction because the problem of induction is always the movement from some to all, and from some features agreeing to all features agreeing, etc. That it's always from some to all. And our entitlement to assume that if cups now, I have a cup, and it's round and red, then the next cup I meet will be round, so on and so forth, have certain cup-like features. Now, consolution is not to demonstrate that we have an a priori guarantee that nature will behave in an orderly way commensurate with our logical powers. Nor do we have a metaphysical or ontological solution, nor even, as I've already suggested, do we have a doxic solution about belief, what we must believe. It's not about beliefs either. Rather, Allison puts it, it is a normative solution. It's a normative solution because the claim is that we are rationally constrained to approach nature as if it's so ordered. But the constraint is a constraint upon our rational activities, right? That's the normativity. And the as if so ordered, the principle of purposeness, in that sense, the principle of purposiveness defines what we might call the space of judgment. Just as the categories give us the space of reason, for those of you who aren't Galerzian. Since it provides the framework, the rational framework, and therefore the normative framework, in which alone rational reflection on nature is possible in general. That's the Copernican term, even more radically, right? To take what was a metaphysical problem about the world and turn it into a normative problem about how we must think about the world for the sake of certain activities, that is, constraints on our rational inquiry and the presuppositions for that. Thinking of the solution as normative explains what Kant means by subjective. Subjective does not mean private. Subjective means not metaphysical, not ontological, not doxic, right? It means about the agent and its powers. And it's for this reason, oh, Jesus, at 10:30 at night, that he mentions and he calls this a new word that he makes up for this purpose alone, the hautonomy of judgment. But it really is 10:30, and no one should have to think about hautonomy at 10:30 at night. So, yeah? Please, questions. We can start here.
I wanted to know then how this would map onto, or if it does not in fact map onto, the very idea of Newtonian science, that the idea that causality is a necessary condition for cognition, or for our cognition of experience, if in this case then our experience of nature is not based on necessary, or isn't as if rather than a necessary.
Not the causality. Right? Again, this is why we start with the problem of underdetermination. So what we're doing here, eraser.
Maybe I can do it pictorially.
All right, that's the Bernsteinian subject. We project the transcendental conditions for the possibility of nature here. Here is nature. And what we see is there's a huge gap between what's necessary, space, time, and the like. And this gap is what I'm calling the space of underdetermination. And it's this gap between the transcendental conditions of possibility and the actual object and is going to be filled in by reflective judging. Reflective judging is going to be the way in which the transcendental categories get attached to the actual experience. So, and needless to say, we think about that when it comes to actual experience, namely scientific inquiry. A scientific inquiry must make presuppositions, so this in-between realm I'm calling the normative. Right? These normative presuppositions governing our inquiry into this. I bet you wish I didn't draw a picture. Even I wish I didn't draw a picture. Yeah?
I'd just like to look back at the question of connection between those three critiques. Mm-hmm. I'm still not so sure about this nexus which Benjamin should supposed to be. So if you could just, because why couldn't we see the problem which is dealt with in this critique as a kind of legitimate and independent transcendental, the process of transcendentality? Just like critique of pure reason or just like...
Ah, good. No. Okay, no. That's a great... Very important.
Because I don't think that he's actually trying to establish some kind of very strict hierarchical systematic structure here.
No, okay. Now, what is different about the critique of judgment and why? I mean, I was going to... That's what the problem of autonomy is all about. The transcendental laws of experience tell us that nothing down here can appear unless it satisfies these very basic principles. It must be somewhere, it must be someone, it must be a substance, it must be so on and so forth. The principle of the purposiveness of nature does not touch an object. The principle of the purposes of nature determines my activity, not the world. Right? So the third critique is unlike the first two critiques. The first two critiques have a priori principles that have an independent object. The moral law is the law of freedom. The principles of the Critique of Pure Reason are the principles of nature. The principle of purposiveness does not have an object. It legislates no object domain. It legislates only our activities in seeking knowledge, which is much, much weaker. Okay. Now, there's a whole story about how much weaker, are they that different and all that, but at least in Kant's mind, the principles of the purposes of judgment do not give us knowledge, a priori knowledge of the world at all. They are really, in his sense, subjective. They do not determine the object. They do not tell us that nature is orderly. The principle of causality tells us it is causally bound. Right? Absolute difference. Simply says we must act toward it as if orderly for the sake of rational inquiry. Does that help? Yeah, so it's a huge difference. It is unlike, so although it's a space that is, shall we say, transcendentally weak. Nonetheless, it's an area of transcendental weakness. Now we may want, of course, to think about a philosophy that works on the basis of weakness rather than strength. And that's where we're going. Yes. Still transcendental, because a necessary condition for the possibility of...
Yeah, of course.
Right.
So, there is this need for nexus, for connection, in the sense that critical judgment supposed to have more importance regarding the previous things. But it is this important thing about it, which is more important, more significant than the previous things.
Ah, you're asking, you want the solution to the problem. Give me another 28 hours. Any other questions? Yeah.
Whether there are gaps of underdetermination which open up also in the second critique, which require...
The answer is probably, and that probably relates to the question of the postulates of pure practical reason, namely the question of the highest good. So that, and again, Guire is interesting in this. Guire thinks you can generate almost everything out of the third critique out of the problem of the highest good. So those who don't know about, I'm not going to try this.
There's a sense in which our subjective orientation here at that is normativity catching utility's check? Which I mean, couldn't we, with a little more parsimony, attribute everything we get from a normative concept to utility and to normativity, which I guess that's the after effect of mapping itself onto nature.
But it's no constraint. Normative, I mean, I say it's a normative solution because it's an answer that constrains our activity. Utility can't constrain an activity. Yeah. But, if you're asking the question whether it depends upon negative consequences, of course. That is, you say if you don't assume this, you're not going to be able to do science. But, that's not going to be utility in any strong sense. It's just negative consequences. Yeah?
For me, the third level of this underdetermination, I can understand what you said, because there are different laws. But
right.
Then why we think they are the same, or why we have this science. But then for the first, in the first two level of underdetermination, it looks rather similar to these transcendental laws.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's going to be the same principle of the purpose of nature for all three levels.
Yeah.
The principle of the purpose of nature is the a priori principle of judgment that governs all three solutions.
What I mean is the first two levels of this principle of progressiveness is like the principle of transcendental, like you say this couple, why we create, why such is a round and we will create a couple. It like the transcendental. It's like the object. I don't understand because of you, this
look,
individual.
The simplest way to think about it is this. The reason why it's not transcendental in the strong sense is we could live without science. Whole peoples did. Whole peoples failed to systematize their knowledge. Whole peoples had aggregate knowledge. No one died. Well, a lot of people died. Most people died. But, But the point is inquiry is a further thing. Concept formation is much more basic. And that's the level at which things begin to... That's why I keep saying it's concept formation. The basic problem is that we have concepts at all. That seems to me like the real issue. We'll get there. Okay, I think I've worn everyone out. Bored you silly. I expect 7 people to come back next week. Please bring the attendance sheet back after you've checked it off.
Wait, so ultimately, he doesn't solve the problem, right? He just dies trying.
Well, I thought I just gave a solution.
No, that's speculative, though.
No, not speculative. It's normative. I just said normative.
Okay. But Hegel solves the problem. That's what he's famous for doing.
There's a
question whether he solves that
problem.
Okay. Are we in week four as far as the syllabus goes?
We're
still
on the first introduction. We're in the introduction. Don't worry about anything else.
What makes the judgment what I recognize is what you did in brilliantly.
Language.
Let me take a language to give it now that you've really done that.
Language.